You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow, is there a lot going on? There is so much that we are going to cover over the next 3 hours. We should be doing 6 hours today. This is, and some of this is like truly scary. Some of it's truly funny. Some of it has some very interesting possibilities associated with it. In our first hour, I'd like to, in our second hour, I want to focus on our healthcare system and the weirdness of that. In the third hour, I want to get into the possibility that, and we've talked about this a lot throughout this week. And in fact, some last week, we've talked about it on and off for the last 9 years. But this is the possibility of true fundamental change coming to America. What Thomas Jefferson referred to when he was talking about the election of 1800, not the bloody revolution of 1776, but the revolution of 1800, the revolution at the ballot box, the New Deal, an actual revolution happening in the United States, change happening in the United States. But did you notice on the news last night, 700 Continental and United pilots marching on Wall Street yesterday? They flew in from all over the country. They took buses down to Wall Street, and they were in a different area than the Occupy Wall Street bunch, because the group who is doing the Occupy Wall Street thing, God bless them, but they're making noise and whatever, you know, they've got their thing, and the pilots wanted theirs to be quiet and dignified and pilot-like and separate. And what they're protesting is the merger of United and Continental Airlines. And they're saying that these airlines are spending all this money on changing the cocktail napkins and repainting the planes, and they won't negotiate with the pilots. In fact, one of the pilots says, "We negotiated in 30 days. They gave up our pensions to save the company from bankruptcy. They're dragging their feet." So anyhow, I asked, did you notice on the news last night that 700 pilots were marching on Wall Street? They were holding signs that said, "Merger process is more than painting airlines. Management is destroying our airline." The group of pilots flew in from all over, just quietly, professionally, fully in pilot uniform. Oh, you didn't see it on the news last night? Yeah, neither did I. I learned about it this morning. In fact, Mark Crispin Miller sent me the note on it. It's like nowhere. Say what? 700 pilots standing in front of Wall Street? What if 200 Tea Partiers had been out there? Which raises the whole issue of flying. Flying has turned into an absolute nightmare compared to what it used to be. And in fact, which is apropos given Pan Am, the TV show, booted off last night. And it seems to be actually a TV show that's got some substance as compared to Charlie's Angels, which is like, badly acted, badly. This is stuff we talked about yesterday with the reporter from Alternet who said, notice how women are being portrayed in these retro shows. But back then, you didn't go through security. You didn't talk to a security guard. You basically, if you had your ticket, you just walked up to the plane and got on. And now it's like, a couple weeks ago we had two Hindu guys, brown-skinned, oh my God, and a half-Jewish, half-Arab housewife who didn't know each other, sitting in the same row. That was deemed a security threat. The three of them were arrested and dragged off the plane. And then yesterday, Southwest Airlines goes after Lisa Haley and Camilla Gray for one kiss. Two women sitting on the plane, they kiss each other, and the flight attendant comes over and says, "Please, this is a family-friendly airline." I'm going to confess, right now on the air, I have flown, I'm a 2-million-mile member on Delta Airlines, a million miler on United Airlines, probably a million miles in aggregate on other airlines. I have flown a hell of a lot in my lifetime, particularly back in the 80s and 90s when I was doing international relief work all over the planet. And Louise has accompanied me on many of those trips. And there have been many times on an airplane when we kissed. In fact, we would frequently do it just as we were about to take off. It's like, okay, if we don't make it, this is the last one. Or say a quick prayer, right? But this, you know, apparently it was because they were the same gender. But this flight attendant comes over and says, you know, this is family friendly. And this is I thought this was so elegant. This is what Alicia Haley said. She said, we are responsible adult women who walk through the world with dignity. We were simply being affectionate like any normal couple. We were on the airplane less than 5 minutes when all was said and done. We take full responsibility for getting verbally upset with a flight attendant after being told it was a family airline. We were never told the reason the flight attendant approached us. We were only scolded that we needed to be aware that Southwest Airlines is a family-oriented airline. And then she gets right to the core of it. She says, no matter how quietly homophobia is whispered, it doesn't make it any less loud. You can't whisper hate. We ask this airline to teach their employees to not discriminate against any couple ever. So here you have, you know, that going on. You've got the fear thing going on. You've got the Chertoff porno x-ray scanners. And, you know, Michael Chertoff making millions of bucks so he can live in his mansion and have a wonderful lifestyle as a result of his service to the Bush administration, now as a lobbyist selling porno x-ray scanners to governments all around the world, particularly the United States government. So that the TSA union up in Boston is saying, we think we've got a cancer cluster here, because these, I mean, you know, there's not shielding around these things like there is, you know, in the dentist's office. Or you ever been in for a real x-ray? I mean, in like a radiology lab, the person doing the x-ray leaves the room and those walls are filled with lead. You got all these people standing in line. You got the TSA workers who are standing there for, you know, 8 hours a day. And the TSA says, no, you may not have a radiation exposure badge. You may not have a dosimeter. But I think the larger issue here with regard to the flying thing and the security thing and the don't you be kissing thing and all this stuff, you know, people getting arrested for all this weird stuff around flying, is that 9/11 and the hysterical response to 9/11 from Bush and Cheney, these two frightened little men, these two, you know, particularly Dick Cheney, this chicken hawk, who there was no war he didn't love, except Vietnam when he was eligible to serve. That the hysterical response to this that is showing up in our airports is turning us, is teaching us to be a nation of sheep. We've seen this movie before, and it didn't turn out well. You can't take pictures. You know, it's been a long time since you've seen any video coming out of the airports. You know why? You'll get arrested for it. Well, who wants to get arrested? Who wants to make a scene? Who wants to, you know, the whole embarrassing thing? And then you've got this, and then when people protest this, not just government, but corporate, basically, intrusion and takeover of the world on Wall Street, innocent women are pepper sprayed in the face.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, our own government just hacked Diebold. Will hacktivists like Anonymous be next? Stay tuned. Okay, so here's what we're establishing. By the way, one of the women who was maced in the Wall Street protests, or the Occupy Wall Street, Her name is Jeannie Mansfield. And she's written a piece for the Boston Review talking about it. And a couple of interesting things in this. One, she says, just for the record, I love cops. I do. My mother worked in the justice system for 30 years, and I've known a lot of really good cops, really good, honorable people just doing their jobs. I've never agreed with the sentiment, you know, F the police, and I still don't. But these guys are screwed up. There was anger in those white shirts' eyes that said, you don't matter. And then she goes on to say, the experience only makes me wish I'd done something more to deserve it after having been maced. Brilliant. The other story, my old friend and colleague, Brad Friedman, who is the co-founder of Velvet Revolution, velvetrevolution.us, and has his own blog and his own radio show, bradblog.com is the website. You can get the information over there. Has pointed out that the Argonne National Laboratory, now this is a division of the U.S. Department of Energy. The U.S. Department of Energy, if you're not familiar with it, has not a lot to do with energy. The U.S. Department of Energy is not, for example, the agency that oversees our coal-fired power plants or even our nuclear power plants. That's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. U.S. Department of Energy is responsible for making nuclear bombs. And, you know, a few other things like security for our nuclear systems. I mean, we've got nuclear missiles that are computer controlled. And so if you go to their website is very simple. It's ne.anl.gov. NE as in nuclear engineering. This is the nuclear engineering division. ANL, the Argonne National Laboratory, .gov. Go to their nuclear energy engineering division, and you will see that they have this thing called the Vulnerability Assessment Team. And right here, I'm looking at this government website. The Vulnerability Assessment Team works in the following areas: vulnerability assessments, tamper and intrusion detection, security countermeasures, tamper and intrusion detection, nuclear safeguards and nonproliferation, vote tampering. Vote tampering?
What?
Well, as hacktivists, this is where it gets really interesting. As Anonymous has outed a cop in New York for brutally macing peaceful demonstrators on Wall Street, many people are wondering if they could also hack, and if you can hack a guy's identity, if you can hack the FBI's pages, if you can hack whatever. I mean, they've hacked all kinds of stuff. Could they hack our next election? And now the government wants to know if it's possible. So a team of computer science and security experts working within the Department of Energy, which is the Argonne National Laboratory's Nuclear Energy Division, the Vulnerability Assessment Team, as I just described to you, says that they have successfully hacked a Diebold electronic voting machine, which, by the way, was provided to them by Brad Friedman on loan. They successfully hacked into this Diebold electronic voting machine, and where they were able to change the voting results without leaving any trace behind. And here's where it gets really bizarre. They were able to do it using $26 worth of equipment that they claim is represents an eighth grade level of science understanding. In other words, any eighth grader in a science class could hack a Diebold machine. The Vulnerability Assessment Team, as they're called, that performed the hack said, quote, and this, keep in mind, this is your federal government, said, this is a national security issue, end quote. And as my friend and colleague Brad Friedman said, and again, you can read this at bradblog.com, this is one of the most disturbing e-voting machine hacks to date. Nearly every other country in the world has ditched electronic voting, arguing that it's not secure. Yet here in the United States, for some reason, we keep it in place. In fact, next year's election, about 30% of voters will use these very same Diebold e-voting machines. So it's no longer about who gets the most votes in our democracy, but which side can hack the vote, which raises some interesting questions. Maybe you have some thoughts on this or suggestions. What if one of the hacktivist groups hacked the Republican primary coming up or the general election? And all of a sudden, you get 35 million write-in votes for Lady Gaga. And she gets elected president of the United States or Republican candidate. I'm pretty sure she's a Democrat. Or what about Scooby-Doo?
Man, this is Spooksville.
Yeah. What? So who, you know, if you were running a serious hacktivist group and you had decided, you know, just for the hell of it, let's hack the election. After all, the machines are out there. They're hackable. You can do it with, you know, 26. By the way, it was like $12 or $13 worth of parts to actually hack the voting machine if you walked up to it. But if you want to do it by remote control from up to a mile away, it's $26 worth of parts. These are the private corporate machines that are counting our votes. So you combine that with this turning us into a nation of sheeple at the airports, to use Mike Malloy's term. And what do you have? You have elections that get stolen by a variety of means in Ohio. Ken Blackwell setting things up so that people stand in line in African-American communities for 12 hours in the rain in order to vote. In white communities, 10 minutes. You have that. You have electronic voting machine results coming out weird. You get 5-point redshifts so bad that the networks had to disband their exit poll divisions. And a nation that doesn't question it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So much like the guy who on the BBC yesterday, who may well have been the yes man, who said, you know, yeah, Goldman Sachsman rules the world. What if the hacktivists...
Just a push of a button. Just a touch of a screen.
Yes, now they're hackable. They're easily hackable. Now we know that pretty much everything is hackable, right? I mean, it's like we live in the age of WikiLeaks and Anonymous and activists, and pretty much everything is hackable. So do we really want to be doing our elections on machines that the U.S. Department of Energy, the agency of the federal government that makes atomic bombs, when they looked at one of these machines, they were able to hack the thing in a matter of minutes with $26 worth of parts and an eighth grade level of science knowledge? Really want to do that? Somehow I doubt it. I mean, it just doesn't seem like a good idea to me. Robert in Edison, New Jersey. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I actually would like for these machines to be put into service, hacked, and then that would force us to go back to paper. I think that, and I've heard this in probably every scenario in education I've ever been in, that America, especially about American history, unless we reach a crisis, until Americans actually have a crisis situation, we don't do anything. We're procrastinators. We wait till we've reached the brink before we try to do the right thing. And I think that if our elections are actually hacked, we'll finally realize that our society can't be totally based on everything being utilized through a computer. And I'm a person that believes in the power of technology. I just don't understand how we can continue to have elections like this, where the threat exists, and we know it exists, and we're even having our government analyze this and realize that there's a problem, and we still don't do anything about it.
Right.
I
think your point is well made and well taken, Robert. Thank you. Speaking as a responsible radio talk show host, I would never recommend to any of the hacktivist groups that they organize a nationwide hack the voting machine program to make Lady Gaga the Republican nominee. I would never do that. I'm far too responsible. Sanchez, East Los Angeles. Hey, what's
everything
up?
Is hackable. Is this the real Tom Hartman? Show me your ID, please.
How are you, man?
I'm fine. I hope you get irony when it's...
Well, yeah. As always, I wish you a muy buenos dias, señor.
Gracias, señor.
And I want to tell you right now about... this is exciting in solidarity and in support of the people of New York City and the world. I'm announcing that Occupy Los Angeles will be kicking off their site this Saturday, this weekend, October 1st, downtown at the City Hall at 12 noon. Again, this is in solidarity and support of everything that's going on right now there in front of Wall Street at Liberty Park. If I can make a quick couple of announcements here, the people in New York City right now, they could really use some socks. Apparently, there's some laundry issues going on, and they're looking for, like, things like that. I've been monitoring this thing since it started on
socks,
Saturday.
Socks, like S-O-X.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, like socks. If I can give out the address, there's a UPS store that will receive packages of goods. They're also looking for these Ever-Ready Energizer packs that will recharge cell phones and their live video feed. They're looking for things like that.
Right.
And if you want to, you can send them to a UPS store. If I may give this address out, Tom?
Sure.
Okay. UPS store is located at 118A Fulton Street, number 205.
Okay.
This is in New York.
Right.
New York, zip code 10038.
Okay.
And if in case...
Sanchez, if there's a website that we can point people to with that information, that's a whole lot...
Yes.
Say that again.
OccupyWallStreet.org,
yeah, okay.
And you can get the information there. But they've had people like Chris Hedges, who's talked about the corporate.
Yeah, Michael Moore was there a couple days ago. No, I'm with you, Sanchez. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. And they need laundry volunteers. So if you're in the Manhattan area, get down there with a laundry basket and say, okay, everybody, give me your socks. I'll go wash them. Then how do you figure out who's where who's? Well, maybe it doesn't matter so much. I don't know. Chris in Bogdan, New Jersey. Hey, Chris, what's up?
It's Putin, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. Thank you.
The electronic voting machines being hacked is nothing new. HBO did a documentary back in, I think it might have even been 2005, on the same exact subject.
Yeah.
Princeton professor hacked the Diebold voting machines within minutes. And
Tina Brown had Howard Dean on her show, and he successfully, this is back when Tina Brown had that TV show on, I think it was on CNBC, And he hacked a voting machine in 15 minutes, live and on the air.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think the most important thing about what's going on in our country, though, is that the media has so much influence over our thoughts that the voting machines don't need to be hacked yet. But I believe that could prevent any sort of revolution from ever happening.
Yeah.
And it was brought up in the last Republican debate when illegal immigration was brought up by one of the candidates that... when they create a database of illegal immigrants, they're not just creating a database of illegal immigrants. They're creating databases on everyone in the country. And we have, you know, digital licenses, the Real ID Act. You know, there's cameras everywhere going up now in New Jersey.
Yep.
This stuff could all be hooked up together for a complete surveillance state that there would be no chance for a revolution. You know, a revolution will not be televised.
Well, not for a revolution in the classic violent revolution sense, But I think that may make the moment even more pregnant for a revolution at the ballot box. The problem is the ballot box has to be secure. And that's why I think it would be just absolutely fascinating if some really weird results were to come out of the Republican primary. So that maybe something could be done before the general election. I don't know. We'll see. I just find that very interesting.
How will we ever know?
I think we'd know if Lady Gaga won a Republican, you know, the New Hampshire primary or something. I mean, you know, it's
I think we would too, but I mean, I don't think it would be so blatant. I'm sure that the people that are controlling the vote.
Well, it might be if some
like that.
It might be if some hacktivists who wanted to make a point decided to get involved. But who knows? I don't know, Chris. I'm merely speculating here. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Like you, I would never advise anyone to commit a felony by hacking a Republican primary.
Yes,
however,
absolutely.
If someone were to do it, I would recommend not using an obvious name like Lady Gaga or Scooby-Doo. Use a name that no one would recognize immediately, which would have a chance to leak out before anyone could squelch the result. My nominee would be Alan Wheatley, because he played the sheriff of Nottingham in the old Robin Hood series way back when, and that's a Republican candidate if ever I saw one.
Mel Brooks. I mean, it's let's see, Gene Wilder. No, it's I don't know, Trisha Nixon, maybe. I there's lots of possibilities. Okay, in fact, maybe that should be our speculation. If you were a hacktivist group, and if you were deciding, of course, nobody would advocate this because, as you point out, it's against the law. If you were a hacktivist group and you were hacking the Republican primary election, though, or if you just wanted to overwhelmingly vote, I mean, you know, it's and thank you for the call. This is something, you know, I've told this story before. I lived in Michigan, which is a closed primary state, or an open primary state, excuse me, you know, back in the day when the Republican Party came right out and said out loud to everybody, we want the Republicans not to vote in the Republican primary for governor or for United States for president, because that was pretty sealed up that, you know, it was going to be Nixon. So Republicans vote in the Democratic primary for George Wallace. And Michigan became the one state in the nation that sent George Wallace delegates to the Democratic National Convention in 1968 in Chicago. Surprise, surprise. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon.
Hi. You know, this is the exact topic plus other ways of stealing elections that have me so really concerned. As much as corporate money and lobbyists and all of that is the hacking of the machines, the disenfranchising of voters, the planned redistricting of areas, the voting requirements that make it hard for anyone to vote. And I feel like I'm in a pretty safe state, Washington State. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, I am not a computer savvy person. I can't go and do hacking and all of that. What can people like us do to help the people in other states fight these kind of things?
Well, I think, and I don't know to what extent the state of Washington is infiltrated with these machines. I know in Oregon, even though everybody votes by mail, they're all counted on these machines.
All of my county anyway.
Yeah, okay. So what I would do is call your state representative, your state senator, your governor's office. Christine Gregoire is one of the better governors in the country. You call her office and call the Secretary of State's office, and who is actually the person in charge of the elections, and express your concerns. And then call at the federal level your member of the House of Representatives and both your senators. And there's like seven phone calls there that you can make. Seven times that you could vote, that you could register your objections.
Is that going to help other states, though, that are in the midst of all these governors pulling all this stuff?
I think when every, you know, we're being listened to all across the country. If you do it in Washington State, where your calls will actually be taken seriously and have some force, and everybody else listening in every other state does the same thing, I think that you know, something will come out of it. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. You have to convey, by the way, that when you call, and you, as I said, you can see this over at bradblog.com if you want the details, that it was our own government, the threat assessment division or team, the vulnerability assessment team of the Argonne National Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Energy that successfully hacked a Diebold machine.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And did so with $26 worth of parts and what they described as a level of scientific sophistication equal to that of an eighth grader.
I wish that I could fly into the sky so very high, just like a dragonfly.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, the Vulnerability Assessment Team at the Argonne National Laboratory Nuclear Engineering Division, part of the U.S. Department of Energy, as you can read over at bradblog.com, among other places. There's also a thread about it over at Democratic Underground, and of course we have mention of it at tomhartman.com and a link out to it. Has the Vulnerability Assessment Team has successfully, quickly, easily, and for less than $25 or less than $26, hacked a Diebold voting machine. What might this mean for the future? Are Americans going to wake up? Are things going to change? Are we going to get our exit polls back? Rob in San Jose. Hey, Rob. What's up?
Well, Tom, you were mentioned a little while ago about having somebody decide that Lady Gaga should be the candidate. I think it's already been done. There was a fellow named, I think it was Al Green, was the Democratic candidate, was selected to be a Democratic candidate in a primary election.
Oh, Alvin Green, yeah, in South Carolina or North Carolina, one or the other.
I will say it was a Republican hacker that rigged the Democratic election.
We had on this show the Democrat who ran against Alvin Green, and Alvin Green ended up being the Democratic candidate against Jim DeMint in that election.
Right.
And Alvin Green was African American, but that really wasn't the hit on Alvin Green. The hit on Alvin Green was that he was inarticulate, stumbling, nearly incoherent. I mean, and had a criminal record. But he was the worst stereotype out of Birth of a Nation. I mean, he was we had the guy on who ran against him, who talked about how in the earlier elections he was known across the state. Not Alvin Green, but the guy who ran against him. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but it's because it's been a couple of years, or a year and a half. And that guy asserted on this program that the vote was stolen. He didn't know how, but he said there's no way Alvin Green won this election. The Republicans set this thing up. There's absolutely no way. They didn't even run the ads that would have gotten people to vote for Alvin Green. So it had to be. And this is the story of Don Siegelman. Don Siegelman went to sleep having won the governorship of Alabama and woke up the next morning where they discovered in one of the electronic voting machines 15,000 votes against him and in favor of Bob Riley, his opponent, the Republican, that just kind of in a Republican district that was discovered in the middle of the night by a Republican operative who was all alone in the building with the voting machines. And, you know, the Republicans then declared, okay, Bob Riley won. And Riley was the governor. And then they began, and then when Don Siegelman started yelling about it, they began prosecuting him. And that story you can see all over that at donsiegelman.com. So there's a long lineage to these things, Rob. Thank you for the point, for the call. I think that's an excellent, excellent point. Scott in Alameda, California. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Yeah, I'm calling because we keep going backwards here. We already know that they hacked the vote with this court filing in Ohio, King Lincoln Bronzeville versus Blackwell case in Ohio.
Yeah.
Where they proved that they transferred the tabulation results from Ohio into a RNC, Republican National Committee server in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yep.
That was used for their email. It was illegal, first of all, because it wasn't. It was
right, and the guy who was in charge of this was the guy who died in the plane crash recently. No, I'm absolutely familiar with it, and in fact, we interviewed his business partner.
Why don't we talk about that more? Why don't we talk about that?
You know, it's you're absolutely right, and it's right there. And as I said, we interviewed his business partner on this show, but it was several years ago. I mean, this is happening right now. Carol in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Tom. I've been a precinct poll worker for 45 years in Virginia. And both in McLean, Virginia, when I lived up there, and now in Charlottesville, we've had terrible problems with the voting machines. So in Virginia, we mounted a huge campaign, and in 2008, we were supposed to go to all paper ballots.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, oh, well, we have to keep the paper ballots for 3 years. We don't have any place to store them. We said, well, store them where you stored the voting machines. They're, you know, same amount of space.
Right.
But no, what they said was, well, you can offer people to vote either paper or computer.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the precinct workers do offer people that, but most of them don't.
Right.
But when you do offer people, you know, paper or machine, a lot of them say, well, oh, I'm computer literate. I can use the machine.
Right.
And, of course, sitting there in the precinct, you can't say, well, you know,
rigged. And here's the other problem. In some states, the way that the voting laws are organized, if you go into a precinct where there's a machine and you say, I'd rather vote on paper, what you're given is a provisional ballot, which doesn't
not
get
in Virginia.
Yeah, okay.
Not
well,
Virginia,
that's great that that's not
a
the case.
Ballot, but it goes through an OCR scanner, which
right.
also can be rigged,
right.
actually.
Right, which is also a private corporation.
But they do have to keep the ballots for 3 years. Now, I used to do all the computer work for Charlottesville for our voters.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the paper ballots, we have found that there were many people, when we finally got the results from the state, which was 3 months later,
right.
These people were not marked as having voted. So you can tell, even with the OCR scanners,
right,
they can rig those.
Or they fail. I mean, one or the other.
They drop the
You know,
vote. Yeah.
I can tell you, you know, when I was a little kid, my mom used to be one of the election people who would volunteer, you know, every 2 years for the elections,
yeah,
to sit there at the table and sign people in and check their,
right,
you know, check their signature against the book. Yeah.
And
they counted the ballots at the end of the day.
You
know,
well, of course.
You know, it was a late night for my mom, you know.
Yeah, you always count the ballots, and they have to tally, and the machine will tally at that point.
Right.
But once it's sent to Richmond, you know, via electronic now, they send it electronic, Richmond will say, well, we just didn't get the votes. We didn't get those votes.
Oh, that's interesting. So the central tabulator, the headquarters basically says, we're going to ignore yours.
Yeah.
Huh. Amazing. Carol, thank you for sharing your story with us. And thanks for being an election worker. This is something, and this is our first line of defense. I say get out there, get active, show up. Volunteer to be an election worker. In some states you get paid for it, in other states you don't. But it's a great, you know, being on the front lines of democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, our healthcare system is on the verge of imploding. I find this really interesting. There's a fascinating dynamic going on here. The health insurance companies are, you know, they don't yet have their 35 million new customers. But starting on January 1st, they have to make sure that 80% of all the money that they bring in, they actually spend on providing people with health care. $80 out of every 100 they have to spend on health care. Now, you would think that a health insurance company would think that their mandate was to provide health insurance, and so probably $90 out of every 100 that they bring in, or $95, or like with Medicare, $97 of every $100 they bring in would be spent on health care, and only 3, 4, 5% would be administration, overhead, stuff like that. But actually, our private, for-profit health insurance companies, in many cases, are spending 25, 30, 35, 40%. There's incredible abuses on everything from marketing to multimillion dollar salaries for CEOs to dividend payments to stockholders to gold-plated faucets in the washroom of the private jets that they own to the corporate skyscrapers that they own to the fancy headquarters that they have to the limousines that drive their executives around. None of that is actually, you know, none of that is vaccinating a kid, setting aside the debate about vaccines. None of that is looking in a kid's sore throat. None of that is providing health care. None of that is curing cancer. None of that is treating people with serious diseases. None of it. So they're being clamped down on before they get all these extra customers. And so what are they doing? They're sticking it to the rest of us. This is from the Washington Post. NCA has been writing, in 2011, for the first time, half of the workers at small firms with individual policies face annual deductibles of $1,000 or more. In 2006, that figure was 16%. Now it's 50%. In just 5 years. At large firms, the share has grown from 6% to 22% over the same time. So what's happening is that because the health insurance costs are going up, the employers who are buying the health insurance plans are opting for cheaper plans with higher deductibles, which means that the employees end up paying the bill. Employees show up at the doctor's office. They think that the doctor's office visit is covered. Nope, sorry, you gotta run up $1,000 worth of expenses first before it's covered. And then it's only covered at 80% or something. So what's happening is that more and more and more of the load is being shifted off the employer and off the health insurance company and on to average working Americans who are not only not seeing an increase in their paychecks, they're seeing a decrease in their paychecks year over year and have been since 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. So is this a system that's about to crash? Is this a system that's about to bottom out? Is this a system that is, and to what extent might that crash bring about a call for national change? You know, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, has in it a provision that says individual states can opt out of the system if they have an alternative that accomplishes the goals of the system, which is to ensure everybody in the state with reasonable health insurance, primary care health insurance, at a reasonable price. Massachusetts has already done that. I believe they are kind of pre-waivered. But any other state has to have a waiver from the Affordable Care Act in order to be able to opt out and do their own thing. And those waivers cannot be issued until 2017. Now, Peter Shumlin in Vermont ran and won the governorship of that state on the platform of single-payer health care. And they passed it through the legislature. It passed through the House. It passed through the Senate. It was signed by the governor. He's got a commission of people putting together the plan because they're literally building something from scratch, something that no state in the United States has ever done. And we do have a sufficiently unique healthcare system in this country that you can't just say, okay, we're going to do it the way France does it. Because they're still going to have to deal with for-profit hospitals and for-profit clinics and for-profit drug manufacturers and all these, you know, and wholesalers. What, you know, this whole bizarre system. But right now they can't do it until 2017. So Vermont is asking, and Bernie Sanders has introduced legislation, and Peter Welch in the House of Representatives, the congressman from Vermont, introduced legislation saying, let us have the waiver by 2014, because by 2014 we'll have our system in place and ready to roll out. And the Republicans are having nothing to do with this. This is not something that the Republicans in the House of Representatives want to have come out. Even though they give all this lip service to states' rights, 10th Amendment, they're not doing that. So what we're seeing is the price of health insurance going up and up and up much faster than the rate of inflation. We're seeing the outcomes, even of insured people, deteriorating in the United States because it's becoming more and more expensive even for people with insurance to get health care. We're seeing the number of uninsured people in the United States continuously grow. And we've got this roughly six-year gap. Well, 6 years, really, until the whole thing is 2011 right now. The whole thing doesn't kick in until 2017 before Obamacare becomes, you know, before the entire United States becomes like Massachusetts. And even then, it's 100% dependent upon for-profit insurance companies because there's no public option and there's no ability to buy into Medicare. Now, my personal opinion is that this is one of those things. This, the insane wars, things like the fact that the Argo National Labs, this is a division of the U.S. Department of Energy, the Nuclear Engineering Division, that has a thing called the Vulnerability Assessment Team. Now, keep in mind, the Department of Energy is the agency in the U.S. government that builds bombs. They have a Vulnerability Assessment Team that looks for vulnerable places in, like, the computers that control our nuclear missile silos. And they were given by Brad Friedman over at bradblog.com, they were given a Diebold electronic voting machine and said, hey, can you guys hack this thing? Virtually instantly, with $26 worth of parts available at Radio Shack and an eighth grade level science knowledge. So if the U.S. Department of Energy's Argonne National Laboratory's Nuclear Engineering Division's Vulnerability Assessment Team, which, by the way, describes on their website, this is an official .gov website. It's nc.anl.gov, as in nuclear engineering dot Argonne National Lab, anl.gov, describes on their website as their job description, including nuclear safeguards and nonproliferation, tamper and intrusion detection, and vote tampering, have declared, yeah, hey, we can hack these depot machines. Will that be the next target for the hacktivists? Are we going to see Lady Gaga win the Republican national primary? Or Scooby-Doo?
Whoop. Man, this is Spooksville.
Yeah. So which is going to melt down first, our voting system or our healthcare system?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Meanwhile, the occupation of Wall Street goes on. It's being live streamed. You can see the live stream over at truthout.org. There's a good link to it right there on their homepage. Okay, so yesterday, the day before yesterday, was a main topic yesterday. A hacktivist outed this New York City cop. The New York Police Department is saying that Officer Bologna, I think is pronounced, or Bologna or Bologna, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name, and I don't mean that to deride his name. It's B-O-L-O-G-N-A. I mean, that word is in the supermarket pronounced Bologna, I think. This is what happens when you're a vegetarian most of your life. If you don't know these things. But anyway, the police department is saying, what he did was entirely reasonable. Walking up and pepper spraying or macing in the eyes a couple of women who were doing absolutely nothing other than standing there. But that's a fine thing. But what I find interesting is the power that not just the hacktivist groups, but foreign governments. There was an article in the Financial Times a week or two ago. I read it on an airplane, so I don't have it with me. But I remember thinking, whoa, that said that it seems that many of the computer intrusion attempts, the penetration attempts of large commercial computers, big corporations, government agencies, and even individuals are coming out of North Korea. So if we have a computer voting system where the individual voting machines can be easily hacked with $26 worth of parts and somebody who's and the knowledge of your average eighth grader, the scientific knowledge, electronic knowledge of your average eighth grader, and they feed their information to the central tabulator for the county and ultimately for the state via the internet, might we start seeing really weird results? I don't mean really weird results like the redshift we saw in so many states going in 2000 and 2004 for George W. Bush, or in 2002 and 2006 for Republican candidates, so many states shifting that after 50 years of exit polls in the United States that were always within a tenth of a point and were always solid, all of a sudden the exit polls were so bad that the big three networks and the AP and UPI, and it was a consortium of five or six news agencies, the big networks and Fox News, that they just stopped funding this consortium that was doing the analysis of the exit polls, because the exit polls kept showing that the Democrats were winning, but the voting machines kept saying, oh, the Republicans won. It's called redshift. And it was happening mostly in strategic states. Now, that got virtually no press coverage, because, the media didn't think it was a story. Give you my own personal conspiracy theory on that, but you can make up your own. B, and you probably already know what mine is. or B, because it was accruing benefit to the Republicans and the Democrat, the Democratic conventional wisdom, the conventional wisdom within the Democratic Party is don't talk about this because it'll make people afraid to vote. It'll further cynicism. And I absolutely understand that. The most toxic thing in politics, it is not anger and hate. The most toxic thing in politics is not the people who applaud Rick Perry's executions. The most toxic thing in politics is not booing gay soldiers. The most toxic thing in politics is not Rick Perry fumbling lines or, yelling, let him die for the hypothetical guy that Ron Paul was trying to answer. That's not the most toxic thing. Those are actually signs in a perverse sort of way of a healthy political dialogue, if you want, for lack of a better word, because it means that people are actually paying attention to the issues and they're engaged. They may have a, from my point of view, sick and twisted viewpoint, but at least they're engaged. The most toxic thing in politics is cynicism. Robert McKee is this brilliant teacher of how to write fiction, particularly screenplays. He does this seminar a couple times a year in the United States and around the world. I'm pretty sure he's still doing them. His website's robertmckee.com, but it's been maybe a year since I've looked at it. I've taken his seminar three times. I was so blown away by it. And I learned so much about, you know, how to write fiction. I've written, I think, seven novels now. Only one is in print, but what the heck. You know, I do it for fun. And I remember one of the classes. He said to the audience, what's the opposite of love? And everybody's yelling, hate, hate. He's like, no. Hate is not the extreme, the polar opposite, the total extreme of love. It's not hate. It's apathy. Think about it. And it's the same is true in politics. So the Democratic Party's position on this has been, if voters think their vote won't count, they'll become apathetic or they'll become cynical or they will have Marty Seligman's learned helplessness. Google that, Martin Seligman and Google and learned helplessness. You'll know what I'm talking about. And they will not show up to vote. And there's probably some truth to that. So what if it was made so obvious to all Americans that these machines are not just manipulable, capable of being manipulated, and that not only maybe have they been, almost certainly have they been manipulated, but they could be manipulated in ways that are the theater of the absurd. What if Lady Gaga won the Republican primary? Or somebody very strange? What if Herman Cain won the Republican primary?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, after all, he won the straw poll down in Florida. Now, that was one of those pay-for-play polls, and Mitt Romney wasn't participating, but what if he won? Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program.
Making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Yes, that would be our limbo alert for the day. And by the way, maybe this is Rush calling out to the right-wing hacktivists saying, hey, there's a Republican primary coming up. Do this. Who knows? Here he is.
We could be on the brink of an historic election. Herman Cain goes on to win the Republican presidential nomination and then goes on to be elected president. Herman Cain could be our first authentically black president.
Yikes.
Stop and think about that.
Now, setting aside the racism inherent in that, by the way, did he say an historic? Could you play the first five sentences of that?
We could be on the brink of an historic election.
Historic. Okay. I was just curious. I've been having an email dialogue with somebody. Anyway, so, yeah, right. But maybe, I don't know. What Limbaugh is up to, I wouldn't want to read his mind, but he sure has a whole lot of people out there. So a bunch of things on the table. I'm going to toss it to your phone calls here. Flying is scary. Leisha Haley and Camilla Gray are getting tons of publicity now. They were, but it's not what they were looking for. They were confronted by a Southwest Airlines flight attendant when they sat down on an airplane and kissed on the lips two women. Oh my God. And she said, this is a family airline. Now, as I said, Louise and I have kissed on the lips on airplanes many times, and no one has ever come up to us and said, you can't do that. Or this is a family airline. So Leisha Haley says, we are responsible adult women who walk through the world with dignity. We were simply being affectionate like any normal couple. We were on the airplane less than 5 minutes when all was said and done. We take full responsibility for getting verbally upset with the flight attendant after being told it was a family airline. And that getting upset with the flight attendant part is what got them kicked off the plane, not the kiss. And she said, we were never told the reason the flight attendant approached us. We were only scolded that we needed to be aware that Southwest Airlines was a family-oriented airline. No matter how quietly homophobia is whispered, that doesn't make it any less loud. You can't whisper hate. We asked this airline to teach their employees not to discriminate against any couple ever. Amen. I am absolutely with you, Leisha and Camilla. And I would submit that this is part of a larger issue, which is, I mean, we're getting all these, people. Last week, or maybe it was the week before last, you had two Hindu guys sitting in the same row with a woman who was who described herself as a half Arab, half Jewish housewife from New Jersey. That was her description of herself. And she had that Mediterranean kind of olive complexion skin. And these guys were Hindu. They were Indian ancestry, darker skin. And somebody on the plane thought, uh-oh, three brown-skinned people on the same row, and they're talking to each other? And the two men went to the bathroom, one after the other. Something's up, and the police came on the plane and dragged them off at gunpoint. We had, you've 90-year-old ladies having to go take off their diapers. Little kids getting groped. Chertoff porno x-ray scanners. Are we being turned into, I love this word, Mike Malloy, I believe, coined it, a nation of sheeple. Is this all part of the process? Be afraid. Be very afraid. Some years ago, many years ago, actually, there was a question of what happens when the government draws apart from the people and the rules become like this. And this fellow who had watched this happen said, this separation of government from people, this widening of the gap. Actually, I should, instead of giving you the punchline at the end, I'll give you the punchline at the beginning. Milton Mayer was an American journalist in the 1940s in Chicago who, after World War II, went over to Germany and spent a year befriending 10 average Germans, from a college professor to a baker. None of them joined the Nazi Party. None of them spoke out against the Nazi Party. They all just kept on with their lives throughout the whole thing and asked them the simple question. How come, how could you have? How did this happen? And here's what one of them said. This was the college professor. He said, this separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, and there were real reforms, too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. I'm thinking of when I stood in line at the airport here in Washington, D.C. last week, or week before last. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, he says, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process, from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing, and one day it is over his head. He talks about how then one day, too late, your principles, if you ever had them, all rush in on you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew, swine, collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed, and changed completely under your nose. And I would refer you to the Republican debates, where they're basically saying, Muslim swine, immigrant swine, gay swine. He goes on to say, the world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed. I'm quoting from Milton Mayer's book, They Thought They Were Free. But and this is his interview with a college professor in the 1940s in Germany. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a nation of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility, even to God. Are we heading down that road? It's a lot more serious than, you know, are the hacktivists going to hack the vote and get Scooby-Doo in, but I wanted to get it off my chest. That, by the way, Milton Mayer's book, I wrote a book review for it for BuzzFlash. You can read it, and also if you just Google the myth of national victimhood and my name, you will find the article I wrote with those quotes in it. And of course, if you're subscribed to our newsletter, which is free, you will get the link. Sue will make sure that the link is in there to that Common Dreams article. So because we send out the entire stack of every article, everything we talk about throughout the day, and a lot of things that the chat room talks about that some of them I don't even get to. But all the cool stuff every day. Anyway, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Tom in Los Angeles. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm so happy we are talking about macro issues such as hacking and Occupy Wall Street and money in politics. And I just want to urge listeners and your viewers to go to www.getmoneyout.com. It's a constitutional amendment to ban money from politics.
Yeah. Here's my objection to that. It doesn't go far enough. I see you and I raise you. And my raise is movetoamend.org, which is a constitutional amendment, which says corporations are not people and money is not speech. If you do that, that will get the money out. But if you only get the money out, you still have the power in.
Right, absolutely. And I agree with you, Tom, because I'm also someone that has signed movetoamend.org and will do everything I can on that.
Yeah.
And
I'm very concerned about these half measures. I had this debate with Lawrence Lessig in New York back 6-8 months ago, maybe a year ago, in which, I was saying that what he was advocating was a half measure, basically, that the Constitutional Convention, whatever it was. And I think that we need to have this just fundamental. You know, when the 14th Amendment was written, it says no person shall be denied equal protection under the laws. And the corporations and the Supreme Court have said that by person they meant corporations. And they didn't. It was the end of the Civil War. This was Reconstruction. This was the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed to strip slavery out of the Constitution. And yet corporations have used them 100 times, literally 100 times more, have used the 14th Amendment than have African Americans over the years.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Is our healthcare system bottoming out? Are our voting machines going to get hacked? Oh, man. And what's going on in the news? We'll be back.
Edward Tucker had a first name, P-E-P-P-E-R. Edward Tucker had a second name, S-P-R-A-Y. She was lonely in the street that day, but got a snoot full anyway. 'Cause New York City's got a cop named B-O-L-O-G-N-A.
Yes, Mr. Pepper Spray, or so far it's alleged, and the police department says, hey, didn't do anything wrong. Pretty amazing. Leslie in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Leslie, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
The conversation you were having earlier about Alvin Green in the 2010 primaries, the Democratic candidate was Judge Vic Rawl.
You're right, Vic Rawl, and he was on this program. Yes.
Yes. Fantastic gentleman. I know him personally, and it made me very sad that day. Anyway, my one thing was, we've had massive voter machine issues in South Carolina even prior to 2010.
Right.
And there have been independent individuals and computer professors that have information, Freedom of Information Act content from a few counties here in the state, only 4 or 5 out of 46, but their overwhelming information about the discrepancies and the inconsistencies in our voting machine. And a couple of weeks ago, our county Democratic Party had a panel of local state and House House and Senate representatives for the Charleston area. And my state senator, or adjacent to me where I live, I asked the question about the voting machines, and he had no idea what I was talking about. He said that he has not heard about any inconsistencies at all in the voting process, didn't know that we have reject machines that were purchased from Louisiana because they didn't want to use them anymore.
Wow.
Had no idea at all.
Well, this is because when you talk about voting machines being hackable, people treat you like you're talking about the Twin Towers were loaded with explosives.
Yeah, or it's a, you know...
Or, you know, the Kennedy was killed by LBJ, you know.
Exactly. And I walked out of that meeting or that Panem forum going, you know why people don't like politics? It's because of the politicians.
Well, we need to educate the politicians. And you know, I think Bernie Sanders' take on this is very rational and reasonable, which is, I don't want to speak for Bernie, but, you know, he's agreed with me on this position on the air on this program many times, that if the reason why we have a government is to administer the commons, the things that we all collectively own, if that's why we have a government, so that we collectively can make decisions about our air, our water, our national parks, our military, our court system, our jails, if that's why we have a government, then the most important of all the commons is the commons by which we select our elected representatives. In other words, the vote.
Yes.
The ballot box is the most important part of the commons. And the ballot box has been privatized. And that's insane.
Yeah, and it should not be one person, one vote, only if the machine works.
Right.
It's supposed to be one person, one vote, and
right.
It's like I said, it scared the bejesus out of me when I got out of that panel forum going, wow.
Right. And see, this is my objection to this is not the machines per se, although I have a lot of concerns about them, particularly get over to bradblog.com. You can see this, but this came out of the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy hacked a machine, right? Our own government hacked a Diebold machine. But it isn't just that. I mean, I think that the Diebold machines are hackable because Diebold's making them on the cheap, right? And they're making them on the cheap because they're trying to be the lowest bidder because they want the government business. Because Diebold also makes those machines that use banks. And last time I looked, it's pretty damn hard to hack those things. So they know how to make a machine that's very, very difficult to hack.
Yes, and they also know how to make a machine that gives you a receipt.
That's right. And so my issue is not the machine itself, although, as I said, I could build an argument against it, and I think every, frankly, all the votes should be on paper, period. End of discussion. But if we are going to use machines, then I think that the machines should be like the old lever machines, like when my mom worked in Lansing, Michigan. You know, she was an election volunteer, and they had both paper ballots, and they had these lever machines. And you could see the gears in the back. I mean, yeah. You literally could see the gears in the back. And you could see the numbers increment as somebody pulled a lever. And by the way, the machines were owned by the government. They weren't owned by the private corporations. They were serviced by the private companies, but they weren't owned by them. And their guts were not leased to the counties may be owning these machines, but the software they don't own. And the software is the key to the whole thing. So I would say if you're going to have machines that the government owns, and have open source software that everybody can look at and try and punch holes in until we know that it's bulletproof, and then have a redundant system of paper ballots. So which would mean basically that the closest you get to computerized voting would be tabulators, you know, those like test scoring machines, you know, like we used in Oregon. And even there, I have some sketchiness about that. But Leslie, thank you. You made a great point. I appreciate the concern. What Leslie was talking about is in the last hour, I said, what if a really crazy candidate got elected? And somebody called up and said, we already had that here in South Carolina. It was Alvin Green. And we think that it was vote fraud that, you know, was done by people on behalf of Jim DeMint. Cece in Pagosa Springs, Colorado. Cece, we got a minute to the break. It's all yours to the end of the hour, actually.
Let's send a fruit basket to all our senators and congresspeople and the CEOs of the health industry, insurance companies, number one.
Why?
Cantaloupes.
Oh, no.
Hello.
No. Sorry.
Just a thought. It's tongue-in-cheek, okay?
Yeah.
Also, this thing with the Wall Street people occupying and not being able to voice themselves, that our police have been more militarized. We even have a SWAT team in my little town, and there's only 15,000 people here. A SWAT team.
Yeah.
The military is part of the big game plan for Reaganomics to take us in any way they can.
Well, I'm very concerned about this, and the thing that set my flags off and put me into alert mode was when, during the Bush administration, they did away with the Posse Comitatus Act. Posse Comitatus was passed in the 1860s after the Civil War, or maybe the early 1870s, and it said that it shall be a crime for the government to ever turn its guns on its own people, the army to shoot at civilians on U.S. soil. That's no longer the law. That concerns me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We have been talking throughout the day about the creeping and, in some case, lurching events of our time that were it all to have happened at once rather than over a gradual 30-year period, probably would have had everybody in America in the streets, from the national security state to what's going on in our airports to the evisceration of our social safety net to these insane for-profit health insurance companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in the last hour, I read at some length from Milton Mayer's now deceased, from his book, They Thought They Were Free, where in 1945 he went to Germany and interviewed 10 good Germans and asked why and how. And I shared with you how one, a college professor said, you know, you don't see this happening on a gradual basis. It's only when it starts really getting in your face. And is it now really in our face? Stefan Hessel has seen that and is seeing this now. He is a diplomat, ambassador, concentration camp survivor, 93 years old, former French resistance fighter and BCRA agent. Born German, he became a naturalized French citizen in 1939. Participated in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. He's the author of several books, including most recently, just published in the United States by 12 publishers, Time for Outrage. Stefan Hessel, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. Glad to meet you, Mr. Hoffman. Proud to be talking to you.
Thank you. It is an honor to have you on our program, sir. I never learned French. The indigenez-vous?
Yes. Indigenez-vous. The N is very difficult for a non-French person. But you will learn French, I'm sure. You're still very young. You have time to get acquainted with that strange
Bless you.
Language.
Bless you. So that is indignation, basically, or time for outrage. Time for outrage. You say, we are told shamelessly that the state cannot bear the cost of certain civil measures anymore, that the wealthy have installed their slaves in the highest spheres of the state. I'm quoting from your book. The banks are privately owned. They're solely concerned with profits. They have no interest in the common good. What has happened to the notion of the common good in the face of all these conservative governments around the world?
It has been completely overrun by something which I consider to be really a lobby, but a worldwide lobby with people like Milton Friedman pretending that any intervention by government in the sphere of economic and finance is just bad. Let us financial tycoons do what is good for us and never mind about the government.
And you talk about two visions of history. What are those two visions of history? That's your second chapter.
Yes, yes. Because I was a great friend of a German philosopher who is well known now, Walter Benjamin. He was a good friend of my father's. And I met him just a few days before he unfortunately committed suicide on the Spanish-French border. He had the feeling that progress was something terrible, pushing the good things aside and making humanity grow more and more irresponsible for public good. I think he was exaggerating, and I tried to convince him that there were forces still alive, and I still believe that there are forces, progressive forces, and that they can overcome this unregulated and corrupted lobby of finance.
So well said. In the previous hour, I mentioned Robert McKee in a seminar that I attended of his long ago, and he said that on screenwriting, and he said the opposite of love is not hate, it is indifference. That's the polar opposite of love. That is the extreme opposite of engagement and apathy. You have your third chapter is the worst attitude is indifference. Your comments on that, sir.
I think it is unfortunately so that many young people, even in all our countries, are only intent on getting a job, getting a house, and they're not really interested in the way that their countries are being driven. They are part of a triangle composed of government, of financial forces, and of the citizen. If the citizen doesn't get his government to resist the economic and social egotistic, selfish forces, then he will be overcome and the government will be overcome. And my fear is that in this marvelous country, the United States, for which I have a real passion and for which I've always had a passion, particularly since President Roosevelt gave us the Charter of the United Nations, and in this country today, it seems to me, there is a lack of support for those who really want to get the country out of the financial lobbies.
This is an extraordinary little book. It's sort of like Mao's little book. It's 41 pages long, a little red book, Time for Outrage by Stefan Hessel. And 4 million copies it's sold around the world. How has your book influenced the European, shall we call them revolutions, people in the streets?
It is, I think, it came at a moment where indignation was already very much alive. But it struck also at the moment when the Arab Springs started. And they are also forms of indignation against their tyrants. And they managed to get them out in a non-violent way. Mm-hmm. I preach indignation and non-violence. Both, I think, go together. And what we need in all our European and extra-European countries, my book has been translated into 30 different languages, it shows that it comes at a time when people just no longer want to be ridden by forces that they do not really control.
And we're talking with Stefan Hessel. Am I pronouncing everything right here, sir?
Yes.
Okay. Stefan Hessel, his book is Time for Outrage from 12 Publishers, and it's in bookstores now. Sir, your ending chapters, your call for action, basically, is nonviolence, and a peaceful insurrection. How does that happen?
Well, in some cases during the past century, we have had enormous progress through nonviolence. I always call on people like Martin Luther King or like Gorbachev or like Mandela. It is not impossible to achieve a solution to basic problems without violence. But of course, the temptation is there. And for instance, in Palestine, there is a temptation to be violent against Israel, just as there is a great temptation for Israel to be terribly violent against Palestine. That is not going to solve this important problem. It is through non-violent negotiations, but they should be supported by the great forces of this world, and particularly of this marvelous president that you have elected, Barack Obama, which should have put all his weight behind a solution to the Near East problem, and unfortunately, he has been overridden by lobbies such as the AIPAC and others, and therefore he is not doing what he should be doing to solve the Palestinian problem.
You have in your lifetime watched a number of revolutions, from the revolutions in Russia, revolutions in Europe, the fascist revolution, the overthrow of fascism. What's, in the minute we have left, sir, what are your thoughts on the near future, the coming future?
I think we are on the threshold of a completely new human society, a global society which will understand that competition, that selfishness, egotism is no longer the way to treat the very serious problems that are in front of us, problem of great poverty and enormous riches, problem of the earth being overexploited. These are problems that can be treated only with all governments together. We have an instrument for that, which is the United Nations. It has its headquarters here in this very beautiful city of New York. And I wish that the United States would support that instrument much more strongly than it has done in the past years. Then we are able to find a new form of compassionate, interdependent solidarity of all the 193 nations working together.
You sound like Dag Hammarskjöld in that regard. Thank you so much. Time for Outrage, Stefan Hessel. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you.
Very good speaking.
Goodbye.
Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Time for Outrage by Stefan Hessel. This is a great little book, and you know, the kind that you just kind of pass along to others.
No more silence. Silence no longer.
Well, it's happened again. Amazingly. This blows my mind. Yesterday, well, maybe it was the day before, but it was reported yesterday, Rick Perry gave a speech down in Florida. Excuse me, Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, gave a speech down in Florida where he was bragging about the fact that he had laid off 15,000 state employees. This is happening in red states all across the country. 600,000 government employees have lost their jobs since Obama became president. Almost all of them in red states. Because they're, and frankly, if they hadn't been laid off, the unemployment rate would be below 8% right now. This is all part of the campaign to keep the economy really, really, really bad so that Obama won't get reelected. So anyhow, Rick Scott gives this speech. He says, and we laid off 15,000 workers. That got even more applause than the fact that the private sector had hired 60,000 workers. And now Chris Christie comes out and says, is this what you were talking about, the Chris Christie clip? Okay. This is Chris Christie comes out and says, in August 1981, the air traffic controllers, in violation of their contracts, went on strike. President Reagan ordered them back to work, making clear that those who refused would be fired. In the end, thousands refused and thousands were fired. And he gets wild applause. Chris Christie, who it appears now is running for president. I just said it to you. There's part of me that wants to say I don't get it, but I can tell you I absolutely get it. This is the politics of other. This is what Stefan was talking about. What happened in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. When circumstances turn bad, and demagogues, political demagogues say, oh, it's their fault. This is what happened over the last decade in the Bush administration after 9/11. And Bush did not say, oh, this is a little group of 5,000 crazies who are, you know, scattered around the world. It was planned in Hamburg, Germany, and in Las Vegas, and the guy who funded the group lives in Afghanistan, and the guy who actually put it together lives in Pakistan. KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Instead of saying, oh, you know, here's the target, here's the people, here's the criminals, like Bill Clinton did about Tim McKay. Instead, he said, it's those people. It became a, for lack of a better phrase, a racist moment, a something-ist moment, a religious-ist moment of them. And this is what the Republicans have been doing so successfully with their base. Their base understands that America's in deep trouble. They know that our jobs have been going overseas, have been hemorrhaging overseas. They know that wages have fallen. They know that a lot of immigrants have come into the United States and are willing to take jobs at lower wages. They look at all of this and they say, why would this be? And the Republicans hand them the answer. It's those people. It's those brown people coming from Mexico. It's that black guy in the White House. It's those liberals. It's those people. For example, let me read to you. Tell me that this was not written by Ann Coulter. It must be admitted that all this was partly the result of extraordinarily crafty tactics on the part of liberals on the one hand and oblivious official stupidity or naivete on the other. The liberals were too clever to allow a simultaneous attack to be made on the whole of their press. No one section functioned as cover for the other. The national papers, also in liberal hands, knew how to camouflage themselves as model examples of objectivity. They studiously avoided harsh language, knowing well that idiots are capable of judging only by external appearances and never able to penetrate to the real depth, the meaning of anything. This form of human frailty was carefully studied and understood by the liberal press. By means of the liberal press, the liberals spread the colossal falsehood about American militarism throughout the world and tried to inculpate America by every means possible, while at the same time the Democratic Party refused to assent to the measures that were necessary for the adequate training of our national defense forces. What soon gave me cause for very serious consideration were the activities of liberals in certain branches of life, into the mystery of which I penetrated little by little. Was there any shady undertaking, any form of foulness, especially in cultural life, in which at least one liberal did not participate? On putting the probing knife carefully, that kind of abscess, one immediately discovered, like a maggot in a putrescent body, a little liberal who was often blinded by the sudden light. In my eyes, the charge against liberalism became a grave one the moment I discovered the liberal activities in the press, in arts, in literature, the theater. All unctuous protests were now more or less futile. Here is a pestilence, a moral pestilence, which the public is being infected. I was happy at last to know for certain that a liberal is not a patriotic American. Who wrote that? Well, if you replace the word American with German, and the word liberal with Jew, that is verbatim from Mein Kampf. That's what's going on in the United States, where you end up with people willing to applaud people losing jobs because they are part of them. Those people who lost their jobs, they're government employees, they're union workers. That's the them. Those people who Rick Perry executed, those were them. Those, you know, it's a them. Those gays in the military that got booed, that's a them. It's time for us in America to take stock of who we are. I mean, this, you know, the president keeps asking, or saying this. He says, this is not who we are. It needs to be echoed over and over and over again. That is not who we are as a nation. And the Republicans need to stop pandering to it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if they don't, they may well be creating something that is greater than even they can handle. I mean, the Tea Party's already out of their control. What's next? Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very frowardly ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, the organization Veterans for Peace. Former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld headlined an event in Boston Monday night to talk about his book. Little did he know he was going to be subject to a citizen's arrest. Nate Goldschlag, a member of Veterans for Peace, walked right up to Rumsfeld and said, "I'm making a citizen's arrest." Others immediately joined in to shout down Rumsfeld before police dragged them out of the building. Not Rumsfeld, but the arresters. Goldschlag later said, "He lied us into Iraq. He lied about weapons of mass destruction. He lied about Saddam Hussein being involved in 9/11. Kudos to the veterans. Now, only if we can get the Department of Justice to do its job and put real handcuffs on Rumsfeld, the real war criminal. The bad, the FBI. According to the New York Times, the FBI's terrorist watch list has now 420,000 names on it and counting. Not only that, thanks to a Freedom of Information Act request, we now know that the FBI keeps watch on that, keeps people on that watch list even after they've been acquitted of any charges. More evidence that the national security state, a massive national security state at that, is growing. Can you say hello, Big Brother? And the very, very ugly, the Republican mob. In another display of heartlessness from right-wingers, a crowd on hand to hear Governor Chris Christie at the Reagan Library in California wildly applauded when Christie bragged about government workers being fired. Christie was alluding to Reagan's firing of unionized air traffic controllers in 1981. Here it is.
"President Reagan ordered them back to work. In the end, thousands refused, thousands were fired."
Yep, that's when the crowd went nuts, cheering for unemployed Americans. Of course, the same thing happened last week when Florida Governor Rick Scott bragged about firing 15,000 government workers again. The crowd went nuts and cheered. I guess we can add government workers to the list of people Republicans don't care if they live or die, alongside prison inmates, people without health insurance, and gay soldiers. That's all very, very ugly. Whew. What a day. What a day. Steve in Albuquerque. Hey, Steve. Thanks for listening to KBQ. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for covering the latest news on hackable voting machines. I think I want to take exception. If I heard you correctly, I believe you said in the last hour that you believe the Diebold machines are faulty by neglect, basically.
Well, and I was pointing out that Diebold makes, and in fact I think is the largest manufacturer in the United States, of ATM machines. For the banks use, and
right.
When was the last time you heard about one of those getting hacked?
Well, I think that you can look at it another angle. I mean, if they can make machines that are secure for financial transactions, then the very idea that they can make election machines that can be so easily hacked with eighth grade technical skills would seem to indicate that maybe they're intentionally designed that way.
I think it indicates that a bank is willing to pay $150,000 or $300,000 for a virtual teller machine, whereas a local county district is not willing to pay more than $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000, maybe $5,000 for a voting machine.
Yeah, well, I understand that.
Because these are basically, but I mean, they're doing them. These are PC-based. These are Windows-based PCs. That's why they're so easily hacked. And they're certainly not using Windows-based PCs for their bank systems.
Well, I think that they left evidence all over the place, though, that those machines are designed intentionally to be hacked or to have back doors to them. I mean, you know, the 2002 election is considered by many people that investigate this scandal as being a test run for the 2004 election, where
right.
In 2002 Max Cleland lost a race that he actually shouldn't have lost, and there was a software patch for the Diebold voting system found on a Diebold FTP server the name of that software patch was called Rob Georgia.
Right. I wrote one of the first articles on that very topic, on that very situation. And our producer at that time was Zen Pickle is his online name. I'm not sure if he wants his whole name out. But, in fact, he wrote the revision of Hitler's Mein Kampf that I read in the last segment. And he lived in Georgia. He lived in Atlanta. And in that election, he went in and tried to put a write-in ballot into a write-in name into the Diebold machine. And he crashed seven machines in a row, all seven machines that were in the precinct where he was trying to vote, one after the other. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them had to be rebooted, and presumably all the votes on all of them vanished.
Yeah.
And there were a whole bunch of voter cards, mostly from urban downtown Atlanta, which is heavily Democratic, that simply went missing for a day or so. And
right.
What was particularly interesting about that election, and I wrote about this, you can, for commondreams.org, it's still up on their site, you can Google it fairly easily. You know, my name, Common Dreams, site colon Common Dreams, that election, Max Cleland, for example, was that Max Cleland and Johnny, Johnny Isaacson? No.
Saxby Chambliss.
Saxby Chambliss, thank you very much.
Right.
Saxby Chambliss was the Republican who was running against him. Here, Saxby Chambliss was running a who dodged the Vietnam War, ran a campaign against Max Cleland, who lost both legs and one arm in Vietnam. On the basis that Max Cleland was not sufficiently patriotic. Max Cleland, who was the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. I mean, that's insane on its face. According to the exit polls, and according to the polls the day before the election and the polls the day after the election, Max Cleland won by 4 points over Saxby Chambliss. But the outcome was the exact opposite. I mean, the literal exact opposite. And the same was true in the case of the race for the governorship. And I'm of the opinion that both of those were flipped.
Yeah.
So
let's not forget two significant quotes. Number one, the CEO of Diebold, Wally O'Dell, said in a letter to Republican fundraising supporters that he was committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year. That's a direct quote.
Right.
And then on the next morning after the 2004 election, Representative Peter King of New York was interviewed on the White House lawn and was asked about the election and the outcome, and he said it's already over, the election's over, we won. This is before
let me correct you on that, Steve. Peter King made that statement on several months before the election.
Oh, several months.
At a party on the White House lawn, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, Alexis, I think is her name, or something close to that, starts with an A, was doing a documentary, which is available now. It's out there in print, about the election. And he was drunk on he was drunk as a skunk. And she walks up to him, and here's what he said to her. Here's the clip.
It's already over. The election's over. We won.
How do you know that?
It's all over with the county. We'll take care of the county.
Yep.
It's all over with the county, and we'll take care of the county. So, Steve, good point. And 2002 was when we started seeing really massive red shift, and it's time for people to wake up to it and do something about it. Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. I appreciate it. Jeff in Palo Alto. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Yes. In California, you can register as a permanent absentee, and so you get a paper ballot. Mm-hmm. And even though they're optical scan, it's a physical thing that can be recounted by hand.
Right.
So it's less hackable than the Diebold machines. And then I've talked to some people who say, well, you know, what if it gets lost in the mail or whatever? I just walk it in on election day and they have a ballot box in my precinct, and I think in all the precincts, where you just, put in your absentee ballot into the ballot box, right?
Yeah. And that's a fine thing in California. In some states, when you try and do that, it becomes not an absentee ballot, but a provisional ballot or some other variation on that name. And in Ohio, for example, there were over 180,000 ballots that after the election was declared for Bush, still to this day, have never been opened because they were the provisional ballots.
But they're still paper physical ballots, so they're it gives us a one way to avoid the problems of the Diebold machines.
Yeah.
So
I'm with you. Paper, 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 paper. Jeff, I'm with you. Jackie in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for all that you do on your show. I wanted to ask a question. And unfortunately, you've gone off on speech TV here in Arlington, so if I could be put back on hold and hear the answer, that would be great. My question is regarding the Federal Reserve. Does our United
States government, free speech TV has vanished for you in Arlington right now?
Something else is on now. Some kind of music.
Huh?
Some people going things.
Are you watching DirecTV or Dish Network?
Here in Arlington is Channel 69.
Oh, okay.
Cable.
Okay, that's on cable. Okay. Anyhow, your question, Jackie.
Yeah. Does our U.S. government, by the government I mean Congress, Senate, the President, Supreme Court, have the power to shut down the Federal Reserve banking system? And if they could, what effect would that have on the central banking systems around the world?
Right. No. The Fed was brought into being by an act of Congress in 1913. The Fed could be eliminated by an act of Congress. But if the government shutdown that everybody talks about, the lack of government funding, were to happen, that wouldn't affect the Fed at all. The Fed is fabulously profitable. The Fed makes a profit on its activities. The Fed feeds much of the surplus of that profit into the Treasury, but they keep a lot of it for themselves. They've got luxurious facilities. Their banksters are very well paid. The Fed is part of the American aristocracy. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. So they would not go away. So I hope that answers your question, Jackie. Thank you very much, David. David, I'm sorry. There's a break. I missed the break. I'll come back to you after the break. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, let's see. Republican candidate Scooby-Doo, Lady Gaga, who's going to win?
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Exposing the con in conservative Charlie in Shorewood, Illinois. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Tom, good afternoon. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, I wanted to ask you if you could give me an opinion. Would the president have the ability to sign an executive order to protect the post office from what the Republicans in 1996 have done?
I think it was actually 2006 that they passed.
2006. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah, that they passed that thing. It was during the Bush administration.
They've been in office a very long time, though.
Yeah, it was called the Post Office Protection Act or something. Hang on just a second. I got the whole thing here. It was called the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006. And without that piece of legislation, which required the post office over a 10-year period to fund 75 years worth of retiree benefits, if that hadn't been put into place, the post office was allowed to operate like every other government agency and every other company in America and just have, you know, current employees fund their own retirements and their own retirement benefits. The Postal Service, according to Ralph Nader, would have a $1.5 billion surplus right now. So there are two competing pieces of legislation in the House. First of all, the answer to your quick answer to your question is no. The president can't solve this with an executive order because it is law. It was signed by Congress, and it was passed by both houses of Congress, and it was signed into law by George W. Bush. So what has to happen is you have to have a law repealing a law. And there are two competing laws coming out of the House of Representatives right now. One is being led by Daryl Issa and will almost certainly make it to the floor and get a vote. And it will call for the post office to basically fire about 120,000 of its own employees. Keep in mind, the post office is the single largest unionized employer in the United States, 600,000 union employees. The second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart, the largest unionized employer, the largest union. That's why the Republicans are going after him. That's why they poison pilled them in 2006. And so Daryl Issa's plan is to just, you know, rip the guts out of the Postal Service and thus begin the destruction of the Postal Employees Union. That's one way that's going through the House of Representatives. Whether that'll go through the Senate or not, anybody's guess. I think probably not. The alternative is House Resolution 1351, which has been put forward by Congressman Stephen Lynch, Democrat from Massachusetts, which says, let's basically just roll back that this stupid piece of legislation from 2006, this Bushy legislation, and let the post office fund their retirements in the normal way, rather than having, over a 10-year period, postal employees pay for the retirement of people who haven't even been hired yet in 75 years from now, haven't even been born yet. And they need a half a dozen or so co-sponsors to get 1351, so where it doesn't have to go through Darrell Issa's committee to come to the floor, where it can go directly to the floor for a vote. And so you need to call your member of Congress and tell them that you support House Resolution 1351 to save the post office. And that's the way to do it. Charlie, thank you for the call. And I'm sorry I didn't have a good or easy news about, yeah, the president could just solve this problem instantly. Tricia in Rancho Cucamonga, listening on K-Talk on KTLK. Hey, Tricia, what's up?
Hi. Well, my comment was just on health care. I heard you talking about it earlier. And I just wanted to say that it would have been nice, or maybe in the future, if they could just offer a separate public plan, kind of like Medicaid or the VA, that people who wanted to could buy into it. Instead of messing with the privatized mess, then just allow people to buy into...
What you're describing was called the public option.
Yes, but it seemed like they wanted to change the privatized plan and then, you know, completely.
Right.
And I think if they just say anybody who wants to buy into the public option, and they could.
Yeah.
And just go from there.
I'm with you.
But
I'm with you. And
I, you know,
unfortunately...
I mentioned that before.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you need to take it up with Max Baucus. I mean, you know, it's actually some of the Democrats in the Senate who sold us down the river on this. The president was out pushing for a public option. All of America wanted a public option. But, you know, Max Baucus and some of his buddies and some of the Republicans, certainly all of the Republicans in the Senate committee that put together the legislation that became the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, you know, they're basically in the pocket of the health insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so we have what we have, which is a half measure. It's kind of Romney care. It's not a terrible thing. So it actually some very, very good stuff has come out of it. I mean, there's a million kids right now who have health insurance because they're under 26 and they're on their parents' plan who a year ago didn't have health insurance. That's a good thing. All right. There's a lot of good stuff coming out of this legislation, but it could have been better. But, you know, step by step. Things we'll get there. David in Altadena, California. Hey, David, what's up?
Adelanto, Tom.
Adelanto, thank you.
I wanted to call because we've been having it way too easy on criticizing the government lately, and I know you're a really smart guy, and I call you quite often. I was going to see if maybe you could answer a question nobody else could for me. I was hoping maybe you could name something that that's the duty of the government or any of its subsidiaries to handle that they're doing right. This is a tough one, and I
think the FAA is
myself.
Doing a great job. It's been a long time since we've had an air crash. I think that the Social Security Administration is doing a great job. Nobody has never gotten a check. I think that the our military works quite well. I mean, it's the direction in which it's working is civilian control. That's Congress and the president. But the military functions quite well. The Postal Service functions quite well. It would have a $1.5 billion surplus right now if Bush hadn't pushed through this legislation to require the current years, this decade's postal employees to fund the retirement benefits for 75 years from now. I mean, there's actually, I would say, find me, David, a government agency that doesn't work fairly well. There's not that many out there. Most of them are running very efficiently. And they're after 50 years of conservative assaults, they've got to be lean and mean. So, I mean, you know, what else can they do? So coming up tomorrow, profiting from prisons, the push to privatize, bad for inmates, bad for America. I'll confront Len Gilroy of the Reason Foundation. Plus, is America's youth really screwed? Saving the future from learning the past. I'll talk with classical economist Wayne Jett about his new book, The Fruits of Graft. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.